My father told me, lying on his bed of death. Boy, says woman, she's gonna make it. Don't fool yourself. Cause she's got something to make a man. Lay that money right in her hand. The very thing that makes her rich will make you poor. The very thing that makes her rich will make you poor. That's right. Well, I'll put you behind the wheel of a 2¼. Yes, I did. Had you living like a rich man's daughter. Yes, I did. I showed it whilst you was living high on the hog. You had me down here scuffing like a dog. Well, the very thing that made you rich made me poor.
The music of Ry Cooder, The Very Thing That Makes You Rich Makes Me Poor, after our discussion of tax fairness in 2015 and policy prescriptions from the folks at Citizens for Tax Justice, and addressing the issues tonight of economic inequality and, again, tax fairness or the lack thereof. Right now, I'm happy to welcome to our program Gary Orfield. He's a distinguished research professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. And he's also director of UCLA's Civil Rights Center. And he's joined us tonight to review the findings of his new report titled Connecticut School Integration, Moving Forward as the Northeast Retreats. And Gary, appreciate you making the time to join us on our program tonight. Thank you very much.
It's great to be with you.
So maybe you could say a word at the outset here about the work you do at the UCLA Civil Rights Center.
Well, the Civil Rights Project at UCLA was actually founded at Harvard University back in 1996, and its mission is to create a new generation of basic research about civil rights and racial equity in the United States, and to inform the civil rights movement with brand new information. One of the things we've been doing ever since the project was created 18 years ago is regularly watching the progress of the dream of Brown versus Board of Education, that we would have schools that were integrated and equal. Unfortunately, in most of the country, the schools have become more unequal and more segregated, both by race and ethnicity and by poverty. And those schools perform systematically unequally. Connecticut is a particularly interesting place for us to look at because it's just about the only place where the state Supreme Court has recently shown real leadership in addressing this issue, not under the federal constitution, but under the additional rights created by the state constitution. And our report is exploring the question of whether or not that's made a difference for Connecticut. And what we found in this report is it has made a very discernible difference, and Connecticut is actually moving towards more integration, while the rest of the Northeast is moving towards more segregation, particularly striking in New York, which has hyper-segregation, the worst in the country for black students, and by some measures also the worst in the country for Latino students.
Well, thanks for that, Gary. And this report titled Connecticut School Integration Moving Forwards as the Northeast Retreats, as it says in the summary here, it analyzes data from 1987 to 2012. And since you mentioned the Supreme Court case, which really put a lot of these policy changes in motion, maybe we should talk about the Sheff versus O'Neill case, which I think in part was argued by someone who I met not that long ago, and that's John Britton, who is a law professor at the University of Connecticut. I think he was a big part of that case, right?
The Sheff case was filed back in 1989, and the Supreme Court of Connecticut decided it in 1996. And John Britton, a professor at the University of Connecticut, was one of the leaders. He's one of the most articulate and distinguished African-American civil rights lawyers in the country, and was a longtime Connecticut resident at the time.
So maybe you can, I guess it's important to understand the data that you collected and the changes in school segregation in Connecticut seen over recent years. Explain to us what the Sheff versus O'Neill case was about. And then, of course, we'll move to the results of that Supreme Court decision here in Connecticut.
Well, Sheff versus O'Neill took place in the backdrop of the United States Supreme Court retreating and reversing civil rights policy. Yeah, basically, the U.S. Supreme Court was reconstructed from a liberal, progressive civil rights mission, which was very clear in the 1960s, to a turn away and blocking civil rights by the middle 1970s after Richard Nixon had a chance to appoint four of the nine justices. In a very important decision in the middle 1970s called Milliken, the Supreme Court kind of drew a line between the cities and the suburbs, even if that was the only way to integrate students who had been historically illegally segregated. So they protected the suburbs and made it almost impossible to integrate many metropolitan areas. At that time, citizens and civil rights lawyers in Connecticut decided to try to seek integration by both race and by social class in Connecticut, and to demonstrate to the court that the Connecticut Constitution was violated and that there were feasible processes by which desegregation could take place. All this happened in the backdrop of the Boston case, which of course was widely perceived as a failure because of the violence that occurred around one high school in South Boston. Even though Massachusetts had had a number of other successful experiments, a lot of people in New England kind of gave up on this issue, especially after the Supreme Court back down. And so the Connecticut case really is a test of whether or not there are rights in a state constitution. And the question was, can you really justify school district boundaries separating kids by race and poverty and denying them equal educational opportunity? And the Connecticut Supreme Court decided that the district boundaries themselves were a violation, and that there had to be something done to cross those boundaries and to make access for the better schools available to more of the children of color. And to do it not in the way it was done in Boston back in the middle 1970s, but through voluntary transfers in which nobody would be compelled, but there would be very substantial educational incentives to experience integrated schooling.
You know, as a backdrop to this, I think people who live in Connecticut are aware of this, but I don't think a lot of people around the country are aware of the kind of economic divide that exists in this state.
Yes.
We have Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport, the three biggest metropolitan areas in Connecticut, and I'm not sure if this is still true, but at one time they were among the top 10 poorest cities in the entire country. And then on the other hand, you have places in Connecticut like New Canaan, Darien, Greenwich, Westport, Wilton, Weston, which are some of the wealthiest cities, municipalities in the entire country. You had this just incredible dynamic of very rich, super rich, and super poor living just miles apart. And certainly, the issue of inequality in Connecticut certainly is right in your face.
Well, Connecticut, as we reported in this study, is the second wealthiest state in the country in terms of average wealth, and of course, generally speaking, has very good schools, but it has this incredible inequality with this deep poverty and severe segregation in the center of its metropolitan areas. That's a basic challenge that the court faced in this situation. It was unambiguous that the educational opportunities were different, even though the state was spending a lot of money in the central cities. They weren't getting equal opportunities. And the court had to face that issue, and because they found a right to integrated schooling in the state constitution, and they had to face the issue about whether or not there was a way to cross those lines that really build in the segregation between the school districts. And eventually they did. There wasn't really a plan developed until 2003. So we're about 12 years into that experience now.
Well, what were the policy tools used to comply with the state of Connecticut Supreme Court order on in the ruling, their specific ruling in the Sheff versus O'Neill case?
Well, what evolved were two basic strategies. One was to use something that had existed in Connecticut way back in the 1960s, which were voluntary inter-district transfers under what had been called Project Concern back then, and to revive that policy and to expand it somewhat. But the main remedy was the creation of regional magnet schools, which would be schools that would draw children from across metropolitan areas in an integrated way by offering exceptional educational opportunities that really couldn't be replicated in individual schools. So the idea was really the magnet school idea from the 1970s, which had expanded rapidly across the country within school districts, and making that work across school district boundary lines. So that's been the central remedy.
So your report, Connecticut School Integration Moving Forward as the Northeast Retreats, what were your essential findings there in terms of how Connecticut, under the directives of the Sheff versus O'Neill Supreme Court case, what are the differences between Connecticut and its neighbors, New York and Massachusetts, when it comes to desegregation?
Well, one of the measures that we looked at was what we call intensely segregated schools, that are schools that are 90% plus non-white. And across the country, there's been a major growth in those kinds of schools. And most of those schools also have very high levels of poverty, since black and Latino students in Connecticut are on average in schools with three times as many poor kids as white and Asian kids. So basically what we found is that level of intense segregation went down over the last 15 years for blacks and Latinos in Connecticut, and it went up every place else. And the differences are pretty striking, because in Connecticut, for example, 29% of black students in 2012 were in intensely segregated schools. In New York, it was 65%. In New Jersey, it was 49%. So, and for Latino students, there are similar statistics. In New England, in Connecticut, 21% of Latinos were in intensely segregated schools. In New England as a whole, 51% were. So basically, we have a very markedly different kind of set of opportunities for interracial contact in Connecticut as a result of the Sheff decision.
And so what I took from your report, and I didn't look at all the details there on every page, but what I took away from it was that there's a high degree of segregation and something you would term apartheid, which maybe best describes these schools, which are, you know, 99% one race.
We found a really substantial number of schools in the Northeast that are schools that are within 1% of complete racial apartheid. In other words, within 1% of the kind of racial separation that existed in the Old South before the Brown decision, and doesn't exist much in the Old South anymore. When we looked at the charter schools that have been created in New York City, for example, we found that over 9/10 of those that were created in Manhattan in recent years are intensely segregated, and quite a few of them are apartheid schools. And we found it was even worse in some of the other boroughs. We found extremely high levels of apartheid schools in regular public schools in some of the major cities in New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We just don't find that anymore in Connecticut. It used to be much more than it is now.
So even though there are high rates of segregation, I guess you would still term it, but it's to a lesser degree than many other schools in neighboring states, right?
Yes, and it's going in the right direction, in spite of the fact that the minority population in Connecticut has soared. You know, there's now twice as high a percentage of Latinos in the state as there were a generation ago, and twice as high a percentage of Asian students, too, by the way. Black students haven't increased much as a percentage, and white students have declined because of birth rate differences, different migration patterns. And this is characteristic of the whole country and of New England, basically. The basic pattern is that there's a gradual replacement of whites or non-Hispanic whites by Latinos around the country. And that's very clearly happening in Connecticut, where Latinos are by far the largest minority group now.
We're speaking with Gary Orfield tonight on Counterpoint. He's distinguished research professor of education, law, political science, and urban planning at the University of California, Los Angeles. And he's also the director of UCLA's Civil Rights Center. And we're talking about Gary Orfield's recently released report titled Connecticut School Integration Moving Forward as the Northeast Retreats. And Gary, what are some of the reasons that we see this kind of racial segregation in schools across the country, in the Northeast in particular, and still here in Connecticut, despite some of the policy prescriptions that came out of the Sheff versus O'Neill case? Is it a situation where many white families are putting their children into private schools? Is it a dramatic shift in the population? What can we attribute this to?
Yeah, there's, you know, any complex change has more than one cause, and so I'll talk about them a little. Before I do that, I just want to mention to your listeners that if they really want to see all the details in this lengthy report, civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, it's all online and it can be downloaded free. Now, in terms of the causes of segregation in the schools, one fundamental one, of course, is the level of residential segregation, which is still high, particularly in central cities, for both blacks and for Latinos. You know, it's gone down in a lot of newer cities, but in the older cities, it tends to be still very high. Then you have the district boundary lines, as the Supreme Court of Connecticut clearly recognized. You add residential segregation to separate fragmentation in lots of little districts, and you're going to get very high school segregation. Then you have the operation of choice plans. If choice plans are operated without a civil rights framework, like charter schools are typically, they usually increase segregation. The way that they operate usually makes things worse. Blacks are in charter schools in the country are more segregated than blacks in regular public schools, for example. So on top of that, of course, there are things that school districts are doing in terms of how they draw attendance boundaries, where they locate their schools and so forth, which are illegal, but which are often still done, particularly in racially changing suburbs. So there's a number of different causes for this. It's not really white flight. It's really declining birth rates among whites and white migration from New England to the South. And the big international immigration into the U.S. and into New England from Latin America and Asia, you know, this is the first time we've had that kind of immigration history, and it's changing the country. So those are the driving forces. There's not been a big increase at all in use of private schools. Almost 9/10 of Americans go to public schools, and that hasn't changed significantly. In fact, there is now a small trend of increasing percentage in public schools. What we have is a whole variety of other things going on. And people tend to think that there must be a lot of whites out there that, you know, just have fled to somewhere. But that's really not true. And it's also true that a lot of suburbs are becoming less white because less white kids were born and the newcomers are increasingly non-white. So those are the underlying factors. It's a big set of changes in our society that we haven't really done much of anything about. We're wasting a generation of adapting to a different society. Our kids and our grandkids will be living in a much more diverse society than our grandparents could have ever imagined.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, one of the essential issues here is that the integration which you've tracked, or segregation in Connecticut and neighboring states, is that there is a correlation between integration in schools and academic performance,
yes.
Graduation rates, matriculation to college, and the like. Maybe you could explain that correlation. Why is integration so highly linked to academic performance improvements?
Well, you know, a lot of people think of schools as buildings. But schools are really teachers and students and curriculum meeting together within different kinds of curricula. And if you get students that are stronger in a school, the school performs better. If the level of competition in a classroom rises, more of the kids who perform poorly will perform better. Teachers systematically gravitate away from high-poverty segregated schools into more middle-class, whiter and more Asian schools. This happens all over the country. It's because there's more of a challenge in those high-poverty schools, and a lot of them get sanctioned because of what I think are inappropriate state and federal sanctions that really punish those schools. So there's a variety of things that cause the difference. If you're in a school where the performance level is higher, where the pre-collegiate curriculum is richer, where you have more experienced teachers, you know, you're going to have a better chance. That doesn't mean that everybody will take advantage of that chance and it'll all work out simply. It's complicated. But particularly if the school is run well, kids who were disadvantaged will do better, have a bigger, better chance in their future life, and will be much better prepared for college. You know, if you are a poor non-white child in America and you want to go to college, college is basically a predominantly white and Asian environment. It's all overwhelmingly middle class. How do you make that adaption? It's much easier if you've lived it earlier. And if you are a white or Asian person living in a privileged community and going to a privileged set of segregated schools that don't have any significant black and Latino populations, you're not going to be ready for the society that's coming along and the institutions that are coming along in this next generation. So there's a chance for everybody to gain through this process. And as it's unfolding in most of the country, everybody's losing, and our communities are becoming more polarized and unequal, and we're losing a lot of talent.
Gary, one thing that I wanted to check in with you about, and I've long understood the inequality in our communities here in Connecticut, in these very unequal municipalities, you know, between Bridgeport and New Canaan or Darien. And I wanted to ask you about county government. It's been many, many decades since Connecticut had any form of county government. But, you know, when you have a county government, you have rich, poor, and middle-class communities, maybe all in one county, and there's some kind of more equal distribution of funds for schools. But when you have a super rich community like Greenwich or Fairfield And then you've got Bridgeport, New Haven, or Hartford, and they're, you know, they're standalone sources for their schools. It makes economic equality in terms of funding for those schools that much more difficult. Now, I know there are formulas at the state level that try to equalize that to some extent, but you know, maybe from my uninformed vantage point, it doesn't look like they're equal schools in Greenwich and Bridgeport, and probably never will be.
You know, one of the things that really struck me, I'm a Midwesterner, and I've lived all over the country. And when I moved to Massachusetts to be a professor at Harvard, I was stunned that there were no county governments that did anything of significance. We have these little villages from the 1600s. You know, the world has changed since then. We know that in terms of transportation, in terms of energy, in terms of commerce, in terms of many things. But we pretend that isn't true in terms of education and opportunity, and that we can just run this as if they were separate islands on different planets. And it's really unhealthy. And it really intensifies selfishness and fear. So communities in the parts of the country that do have countywide school systems, and there's quite a few states that have that, everybody has to worry about all the schools for all the kids, not to just try to move across a boundary and get something and protect themselves and shut out others. You know, we need to think more regionally, and I think that's why the regional magnets are a really good step, because we're thinking regionally, and nobody's coerced to do anything, but you're seeing the advantage of regional cooperation in terms of offering something that none of the individual units could have produced.
So it's kind of like a surrogate county government within that school in terms
of...
Well,
it's a showing that cooperation can produce, you know, win-wins. It's not... Education really isn't a zero-sum game. Education happens to be a positive-sum game that everybody can actually win, with nobody losing significantly, but everybody winning on different dimensions, if it's run properly, as it is run in this regional magnet process.
Well, Gary, we're almost out of time, and I'd just like to have you make a final point here in terms of the importance of this research that you've conducted in Connecticut's journey after the Connecticut Supreme Court decision in the Sheff versus O'Neill case, and the policies that were implemented that have had shown success in your study about lesser evidence of segregation or apartheid schools in our state compared to our neighbors. And please also leave us with the web address one more time where people can get a hold of that report.
I think people in Connecticut really have something to be proud of, you know, and that a lot of the educators and community leaders have done something truly good for their community. And it should be taken to the next stage. There should be the moratorium on more regional magnets outside of Hartford should be lifted. This is a good thing. We shouldn't ration it. We should create civil rights requirements for charter schools of the same sort that we use in the regional magnet schools. It's within the authority of the state government, and they have failed to do it so far. We should do a lot more about housing integration, supporting racial change in our communities in a way that lasts and is positive rather than is resegregation. Those are things that could be done to build on this success and to take it to the next stage. And I think people in Connecticut should look at this report. You can see it at civilrightsproject.ucla.edu, and you are free to reproduce it without any charge. And think about whether or not this shouldn't be built upon. This is a tangible accomplishment. Most so-called school reforms don't produce anything like this. This is something that really has worked, and it's good on many dimensions for the states. So I hope people will look at this and decide, you know, we've really done something here. Let's take it to the next level.
Well, Gary, I've been told I focus too much on bad news on this program, but I'm happy you were here to share some good news about some policy changes that have taken effect and apparently are working. So that is a lot of good news. And thanks for your work on this research showing us the way forward, if we choose to. All right.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Good night. That's Gary Orfield, a Distinguished Research Professor of Education, Law, Political Science, and Urban Planning at UCLA. He's director of UCLA's Civil Rights Center. And again, the title of that report we've been discussing tonight about Connecticut is titled Connecticut School Integration Moving Forward as the Northeast Retreats.